Hello and welcome to the journalism.co.uk podcast, a show where we bring you insights from media industry experts to help journalists do their jobs better. I'm your host, Jacob Granger. Today, we'll be talking about how to take your conflict reporting deeper through participatory journalism. Yemen remains one of the world's largest humanitarian crises. Civil war within the country has waged for the last 9 years at this point, causing economic collapse and more than half of the population, 18 million people, including nearly 10 million children, to require life-saving support, according to UNICEF figures. In a bid to remind audiences everywhere of this critical news story, non-profit newsroom The New Humanitarian has just published its Yemen listing project. But there's a twist. This is a participatory journalism project that has seen more than 100 people submit contributions, expressed in their own words and in their own ways, on how their lives have been impacted by the ongoing conflict. We're speaking to Middle East editor Annie Slemrod, who oversaw the project, and Yemeni refugee Nuha Al-Junaid, who was brought in to coordinate all the contributions. We'll be covering how to encourage people to come forward with their contributions, workflow tips on how to manage the stack of submissions, and some of the risks to bear in mind too. That's all coming up, so don't go anywhere. Annie, Nuha, welcome to the journalism.co.uk podcast. It's brilliant to have you both on our show. We're going to talk a lot today about the New Humanitarian's Yemen Listening Project. Annie, I know that you're the one that's sort of had the initial idea for this. You pitched, you got it approved internally. Why don't we start there and just tell us about the idea that you had for this project?
Yeah, I had been thinking about this project for, at this point, a few years, although I'm not sure I can date to when it came to mind exactly. But, you know, as I'm the Middle East editor at The New Humanitarian, which is a nonprofit newsroom that focuses on humanitarian crises and the aid industry. And I had been working on and reporting from Yemen for a really long time and working with journalists in Yemen. It's been 9 years this week that Yemen has been at war, and it has been called the world's worst humanitarian crisis. We're talking about a population of more than 30 million people, where the UN says, I think the number is 80% need some sort of aid. Most probably won't get it. 4.5 million people have had to flee their homes. It's been on the brink of famine. Hundreds of thousands of people have been killed by bombs, bullets. They can't get health care. There was a cholera outbreak, hunger, multiple foreign powers involved. And still, it really rarely makes the news. And when it does, I think in the mainstream media anyway, the news really rarely gets to speak to the voices of regular Yemenis about what it's really like to live through this kind of catastrophe. I think there are reasons for that. It is a very difficult place for foreign journalists to access. The other is that it's incredibly dangerous for Yemeni journalists to do their jobs. Many have been imprisoned, have had to flee their homes. And it can be dangerous for people to speak out to. I was frustrated. And I have come to know a lot of Yemenis, and I know that they have stories and things they want to say, and I know that they did not feel heard. And I started thinking of this idea of a listening project. I think that journalists, a lot of times, we go in search of a story, and that really drives what people tell us, and it drives what we see. Of course, when you have a certain angle, that happens. You know, I find even in regular interviews, stepping back and asking people questions like, what didn't I ask you, or what do you really want to say, can open up a conversation. And I pitched it internally, and my colleagues were, some were excited, but everyone was like, we need to, you know, refine this idea. And it took a long time to figure out how we could do it in a way that our audience in particular would be interested in, how to design this, how to fund this. And yeah, so I guess it came out of frustration and sort of a realization that as journalists, we need to listen more and maybe talk a little bit less.
And so one of the things you did, of course, is that you brought in Nuha, who's with us now, to really coordinate and oversee and manage the types of contributions that were coming in for this project. And Nuha, I mean, Annie said there that Yemenis feel like their perspective is not really being shared in the news cycle right now. Is that your personal experience as a Yemeni refugee yourself?
Yes, it is. Most Yemenis, or myself, feel that they are not heard, not being heard as it's supposed to be. Mostly the stories of Yemenis or the voices of Yemenis has been told by either reporters, journalists, politicians, until now, I mean. But in this project, we used the participatory journalism to convey Yemeni stories and voices to the world, letting people themselves talk about themselves and let their voices be heard.
So I imagine this has been an enormous labor of love for the two of you, and more than 100 contributions across the project. And Nuha, when you look at the types of different submissions, I mean, they're not all bleak. There is some success in here as well. But how much of that did you relate to? And what did you think of the sort of diversity of submissions that you managed to glean throughout this project?
Yes. So basically, when I look back, I see that the project is really diversified. It was one of the strategies that we worked on from the beginning. I made sure that diversity, equity, and inclusion is very important in this project. That means we try to approach people from different geographical areas in Yemen, from diversified ages or educational backgrounds, and to make it as inclusive as possible. But the surprise was also these stories. They were really inclusive and they were really diversified. And that really surprised me and made me happy at the same time.
Yeah. It made me realize, I think, how much we are missing, either we as consumers of media. You know, when it takes 2 days to get somewhere that should take a couple hours and stops you from getting to the hospital or stops you from seeing your family, that's really not something that comes through. You know, when you think about Yemen, like, what are people day to day dealing with in a war? Probably blocked roads is not one of the first things you think of, but that came up so much. And there were a few other things like that, education being one of the main ones that I think became a major theme.
So the stories tells you a lot about things that if you don't know a lot about Yemen, you don't realize become a big issue in your life. So it is something also that not being heard or told before, because you are talking to the Yemenis themselves, not talking to agenda holders, to politicians, or to media.
Just a quick one from me, and then we'll get back to the show. Join us on the 22nd of May at our next digital journalism conference, News Rewired, in London. We've got plenty of talks on generative AI, newsletters, young audiences, and much, much more. I'll be there, and I'd love to see you there too. Head over to newsrewired.com for the full agenda and to grab your place today. Annie, I mean, this isn't the first time you've done participatory journalism. A few years back, we turned our attention to your WhatsApp Lebanon series, which kind of had a similar-ish kind of model working for it. I think fewer participants in that one, but maybe more detailed in the types of exchanges, because you could see sort of the WhatsApp messages coming together. I just wonder, you know, how have you refined this process over time in terms of your workflow when it comes to participatory journalism?
What's Up Lebanon was told the story of Lebanon's economic collapse through this English-Arabic timeline showing the WhatsApp messages of five people. Actually, originally, we had thought, I'm just going to put a call out on social media and see if people want to share their WhatsApp messages. I learned very quickly, no, that doesn't work. That not everyone wants to go through the WhatsApp messages from the most traumatic time in their lives. And that's also, if you put a call out on Twitter, you're going to get people who are on Twitter. And so in that case, working in also with a Lebanese project coordinator, Zainab Shamoun, we decided to work with five specific people who also came from different religions, different segments of society. I wouldn't say they're representative, because I'm not sure they would want to necessarily represent all of their communities, but showed, you know, just different, how diverse Lebanon is. So it made me realize that we needed to do a lot more planning before I started. So Nuha and I worked very closely. She mentioned diversity. She was very clear on gender inclusion, speaking to people with disabilities, various religions. That was built into our plan from the start. So Nuha did put out calls on social media, but this time we planned to focus on ways that Yemenis want to communicate. So we set up a dedicated WhatsApp line with Nuha on the other end. That's a Yemeni number. We set up a Facebook group, which, you know, I was like, oh, only my grandma uses Facebook. But Nuha was like, no, all Yemenis use Facebook.
No, yeah, exactly. So we dedicated WhatsApp line and Facebook because we thought that this is how Yemenis communicate.
Yeah, basically, I think our internal motto was meet people where they're at. We made it really accessible. So you could, if you wanted to fill out a form on our website, you can. If you want to send an email, you can.
If you want to send a Facebook message, you can. And you, and there is a dedicated WhatsApp line that you can just go and either make a voice record and put a note, a personal story, a video, whatever you want.
We probably weren't going to necessarily reach people everywhere. In the places where we found we just weren't really getting the reach that we wanted, we had journalists go, local journalists go and talk to people, explain the project and record their stories, so that we were able to cover places that maybe for whatever reason we just hadn't accessed. And I guess the other thing was, which is very nitty gritty, is I refined a lot of my project management skills. You know, this whole, if you see the project or one version of the project anyway, it's 100 stories in Arabic and English. That's a really, really big spreadsheet, which was designed, and that was designed with our web designer in advance, knowing what, and refined along the way, but knowing what fields we're going to need to get in. So as Nuha is getting in, I guess what we could call the data, but which is just really just people's personal stories, she can go in there and put in their name in Arabic and English, where they're from, their age, every single bit of data that we were going to need, so that it's not, as it was in previous projects, a massive scramble for the people on the web design and development end of things.
Well, how did that reveal any blind spots that you were missing, though? How did you become aware of what you were missing?
In terms of geographically?
The diversity of stories, geography, gender, disability, anything really.
So we had every story knew how logged where people were from. So we could see in the spreadsheet where we're getting stories in from, where they're originally from, how old they are, and their stories. So you could see it all as it was coming in. And we did wait until we had a limited time period for submissions and a deadline, which we actually extended by request.
Extended because we wanted more inclusivity about these things. So Jacob, I want to highlight one point here, is that the importance of working with Yemeni person in this project. So Annie was really aware of the importance of working with Yemeni in this project, because if you meet with someone from Yemen, he would understand more the geographical challenges. For instance, I would give an example of Socotra or Marib, Hadramaut. There are governorates that really very sensitive if you want to get female voices or stories from. So understanding these types of things helped us to put a roadmap before, and most of the anticipations were right.
Nuha, maybe you could explain why it's really hard to, because probably most people wouldn't know why it's so hard to get a voice from there.
Yes, it is very complicated, and it is not really acceptable for a female voice to speak out of Saada. And also male voices, they're very conservative about sharing their stories with either a foreign entity or with the Yemeni person themselves. So it was a really big challenge, but I worked hard to get a voice, and it was luckily a female and with a wonderful story, a success story that I was really happy with. So
Well, how did you do that, then, Nuha? If it was so difficult, how did you overcome that situation?
No, Jacob, I'm a Yemeni person. I'm not saying here that they wouldn't trust a foreign person, but of course they would know and be more open to speak to someone that speak their language, understand their background, and also one of them. So it was through my personal network, of course, and it took me a great effort.
So you really had to work hard proactively to get that one.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I would like to add, because I remember Nuha was concerned about this diversity from the start. So when people, you know, even people she didn't know would message the WhatsApp line, or and she would talk to them, she would say, have you shared this with your grandma?
Yes.
Do you know anyone else? Because we didn't want to just get people who are, you know, really super online.
Did that work?
Yes, it worked hard. And it is a personal proactivity as well as a belief of what you're doing. So if you really want to get as many voices as possible, you would try everything you can. So I spoke to people who has WhatsApp, but then asked them, do you have a grandma? Can you record her, please? Can you ask her if she doesn't mind to share her story as well? Do you have a neighbor who's disabled or who has lost some limbs in the war, can you please go and ask them if we can record them, if they're okay with it? So lots of effort has been put here. They're not just random stories.
What I love about that is there's kind of an acknowledgement there that you as the coordinator can only go kind of so far, but everyone kind of knows somebody, and through extending their networks, you're able to tap into a wider field of possibilities and contributions.
Yeah, we also tried to get people in the diaspora, and we did, which I'm really pleased with. We did a few unorthodox things, maybe.
Do tell.
I'm not sure if this should make it this into the podcast, but as Nuha knows, so I'm originally from Michigan, which is where one of the biggest Yemeni diasporas in the world is. And we printed out a whole bunch of flyers, and my parents became the street team, and they went to every Yemeni coffee shop and restaurant and asked if they could. We had a flyer with a name and a QR code so you could go to it, and they flyered all over. I mean, of course, with permission. My dad really enjoyed it because he got to try lots of different Yemeni sweets. coffee. He was like, I'll do this if you tell me what to order. And we did end up getting some contributions from the diaspora, some of which were really, really moving stories about exile and what it's like to be a refugee.
Getting to Yemeni voices, it might be really hard, but it is also, I sensed the hospitality in sharing their stories as well.
They were relieved to be telling their stories.
Yeah, Yemenis are desperate to be heard. Desperate, they need it. And they wanted someone to go and speak about their voices, but they were like, maybe not trusting famous voices or, let's say, parties, because it will end up either using their voices to a special benefit or to use under one agenda or another. So being neutral here.
Yeah, they want to entrust their stories with someone like them or someone who's going to, you know, take care of their story properly.
Exactly. And with someone neutral who doesn't really emphasize their opinion, do not try to influence the story of the person. Just ask them this one question and let them talk about themselves.
Sorry, what question? Which question to ask?
How has the war impacted your life?
How has the war impacted your life? It's a simple question, but one that the team put a lot of thought into, as they felt it would help people to think about their own situation rather than the politics at play within the country. And it worked. They only received a few heavily politicised contributions, and they didn't make the cut. As we've explored, what helps people come forward with contributions is partnering with people either from the local area, who speak the native language, or have a deep appreciation of the context in the country. But when someone does come forward, provide flexibility in the remit of what they can talk about and the form that can take, with editorial oversight of course, and don't miss the opportunity to extend the offer out to their friends and family. What can also help are FAQs that manage expectations with sources, explaining who the news organisation is and what its mission is, why they are pursuing this project, and what will happen to their story next. And this is another reason why it pays dividends to have a local citizen on board for the project, as they will anticipate many of the likely types of concerns. The downside to partnering with people like Nuha, who have been displaced by the war, is that the stories she was capturing brought back painful memories and triggered her PTSD to the extent that she needed to take up therapy. It's why it's crucial that news organisations extend mental health services to freelancers as well as their own staffers.
This project is a bittersweet one. It brought up lots of sad memories to me, lots of traumas. I could resonate myself to so many stories that I've heard or read. A Yemeni person, despite where I'm located right now, I still belong to that place. When they were sad, I was crying. When they were misery, I was going through a hard non-sleep nights. And I got some PTSD back. And I had to speak to someone. And I was continuously having therapy sessions in order to deal with how do I feel about it.
You know, we've been checking in with each other a lot, and there were times when we were both...
No, it is coping with the pain.
Yeah, that's true. That is something that also came through in a lot of the stories, that people talked about how the war had impacted their lives. A lot of people mentioned anxiety, stress, mental health. Neuha was interviewed very, very, very early in the project and was asked about if this was healing for her. And she was like, no, therapy is healing. And I thought that was wonderful because, you know, as a journalist, I think we often think of storytelling as healing.
Mm-hmm. No, they offered me this, to be honest, but I felt more convenient to continue with my therapist because he knows the history of, you kind of build relationship after a long time with the same therapist. But thanks to them, they offered me this.
Jacob, you probably know this in the being in the industry, but there's been a lot of talk over, I think, a lot more over the last few years about journalism and trauma and vicarious trauma and mental health. I don't know how much it's really changed things, to be honest, but I do appreciate that the conversation is happening for me and for at least the two of us. And also in my own personal work, separate from this project, there's a really big value in having someone check in with you and saying, are you okay? Do you need to take a break? And frankly, I did have to take a break for other reasons related to my work. And Neuha was one of the people who was like, okay, this we need to take a pause. You need to step back for a while. Mm. And that is, that's really important. And we don't really, honestly, we don't take that many breaks in journalism. So... I think it matters.
Is mental health the only risk associated with a project like this, or were there other things that you thought about?
No, I mean, mental health was very key for us, but when you have a project like this, I have thought a lot about, I guess what you would call citizen journalism, which I think is a little bit different, but where people, I don't know, share videos that turn out, during the Syrian war, for example, which is when I first started working, you know, that turned out not to be of what they purported to be. Frankly, this is happening everywhere, right? Verifying stuff that you see on social media or whatever, it's a whole job. And, you know, we realized from the start, okay, we can't verify the details of every individual story. And that's a caveat that is on the project when we published. However, I did go through every single story and make sure that it wasn't outlandish, that this made sense with what was happening at the time, fact-checking in a very specific way. We were also concerned about risks to people who shared their stories, which is the times that we decided to remove certain identifying details. We also offered people the option, you can submit anonymously.
Yeah, it is a sensitive situation in Yemen. And understanding this gave us the responsibility to give people options to answer us, but also keep their privacy. And also, I want to mention that we also gave options on how they can answer the question. They can answer it with a poem, with a photograph that they have taken, with a painting. Thinking of, yes. So these things are also messages. And these are amazing tools that tells a lot about Yemenis. Yemen is more than a war, Jacob.
I think this was one of the hardest parts for me crafting at the very beginning, because, you know, when I was consulting with various people, Yemeni colleagues, Yemeni journalists, a lot of them said, Yemen is more than a war and we want, you know, you should make that come, you know, come through in the project. And I was thinking, I want to just ask the question, tell me your story. But of course, if you ask, just tell me your story, that could be anything, this, you know, and we need to have some kind of focus because there is, at the end of the day, the audience needs to be able to read this, to see this, etc.
I get that. A lot of the benefit of this project has been allowing Yemenis to sort of tell their stories and have a platform for that. But Annie, you also have your own readers to think about. And I know this project has got out in English and Arabic.
Sure.
How did you think about making this relevant for a more broader, general, international audience?
Yeah, so audience was built in from the start. So two audiences. One of them is the Yemeni audience, possibly Arabic or wider Arabic-speaking audience. The other was the audience that I call my mom, which is a person who is interested in the world, but maybe doesn't have a lot of time or energy to devote to a conflict which is very complicated, like Yemen, which frankly, since it isn't in the news a lot, you'd have to work pretty hard to find out about it. But that person relates to personal stories. So we built this keeping both of the audiences in mind, which is why it's in Arabic and English, and which is why there are different, I guess, what you would call products. So we have our website, which is around 100 stories in Arabic and English. I should shout out to the web designer and developer, Mark Duby. The website is purposely built to work on mobile and to work with low bandwidth, slow internet. We wanted to keep the Yemeni audience in mind there. But to capture the My Mom audience, well, we chose several stories that we wanted to pull out, and we recorded them in Arabic and English, which we could use then on podcasts. So people who maybe relate by hearing these personal stories in audio, in English, those also have been turned into little videos that can go on social media. So people who consume on Instagram can see them that way. And we had a partnership with Al Jazeera, where they have an illustrated interactive of 7 of these stories. So that's sort of an easier way in for someone who maybe doesn't want to dive quite as deeply into all the stories right away. So we tried to give our different audiences lots of ways to get into it. Of course, I hope that people will spend, you know, loads of time going through and clicking on every single story, but I know that may not be the case. Ideally, I think if these different products get people to start paying attention, I think that would be great. So that was, that was the plan. And also our audience, I guess I should say, does include a lot of people in the aid world. You know, we thought about that in the framing of the story. You know, when I was talking internally saying I want to do this story, one of the things I said is a lot of foreign aid workers or people who plan these $1 billion aid response right. in Yemen don't actually get to talk to real Yemenis. They're living in compounds, et cetera. So this is actually a value to them as an audience as well. So we tried to think of ways. I mean, this is something I've been doing a lot. I did a lot of audience mapping from the beginning of how we can reach these different audiences. And, you know, if you look in the website, you can also see each story has little tags. So if you're interested in the issue of roads, which Nuha mentioned, you can see all the stories that mention roads. And it's a lot. If you just want stories with video or audio, if you want to read about displacement, you can see that too. So we try to make it as easy as possible for people to care and to read.
Okay. Well, listen, let's wrap up with one question to you each, which is for our audience listening in who might want to do a participatory journalism project themselves, what would be your top tip each? Nuha, I'm going to start with you.
Well, I'm not a journalist, but...
That doesn't matter. Work with a non-journalist, maybe. Sorry, go ahead. Start again.
Yeah. I think with participatory journalism, it is very important not to influence the participants about what they say, and also to make lots of effort on planning, conveying your idea or question as simple and direct as possible.
That's great. Yeah. Don't influence participants and, you know, plan your vision very well. Annie, what about you?
Top tip is
work with Nuha.
What did she say? I missed that.
Top tip. She said work with Nuha.
Nice plug.
Yeah. Top tip. Hire Nuha. But if you can't do that for every project, top tip is let the process be a collaboration. Make space for failures or, let's say, stumbles and adjust along the way. Was that 2 tips?
No, that's 2 tips. You're allowed 2 tips. And I particularly like the one about making space for failures and stumbles. So with all that being said, Nuha, Annie, thank you ever so much for coming on our podcast, talking about the Yemen Listening Project. It's been a blast. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
My takeaway for today is that contributors open up when they can express themselves more freely and are given an open-ended question like, how has the war impacted your life? It also helps to bring in people who have the lived experience to empathise with what they've gone through, but that comes with a heavy toll, that this might be triggering to their own mental health, so be aware of that. But what did you take from today? I'd love to know. Find me on LinkedIn, Twitter, Twitter /x@jpgjournalism or email me on jacob@journalism.co.uk. You can check out all of our episodes on all your usual podcast platforms like Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Just search and subscribe to the journalism.co.uk podcast. But that's all we have time for this week. I've been your host, Jacob Granger. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time.